Thank you for that really sweet introduction, Sonia. I appreciate that. So this morning, Sonia asked me if I would do a class or a talk on vow. We did talk about vow as intention and direction and all that kind of stuff, but my mind didn't get past vow, and I said, no. Because the only thing I really know about vows is how to break them, which I do very well and do on a very regular basis. So how can I possibly teach a class on vow? And we talked some more about it. And then I said, well, okay, I don't know anything about vows for priests, so if it's part of the priest training, I'm not going to do it. She said, no, don't worry about that. That'll be okay. Because I'm not a priest, and so I can't really speak to vows as they would relate to being a priest or priest training. But we talked some more, and I realized in the end that I do know something about vows. So as long as I could tell a story about my own experience and I didn't have to sound like, you know, some authority on vows, then it would be okay. And that was okay with Sonia, so okay. So then I will. Yeah, as I said, really mostly what I know about is breaking vows, because in the Mahayana, which we are all in the Mahayana as Zen practitioners or as Tibetan Vajrayana practitioners, we are on the great vehicle. We find ourselves frequently in situations where vows are presented to us, and we're asked to take vows of one kind or another. And as a layperson, the kind of vows that I'm asked to take are mostly basic kind of stuff that look a whole lot like the golden rule in the Western tradition. But nevertheless, I know some of those vows I'm going to keep and some of those vows I'm going to break. So for as long as I've known my wife, I've been faithful to her. So vows about sexual misconduct, I don't really worry about. You know, I know that that's not going to be an issue. And I'm an honest person, so I don't tend to worry about that sort of thing. Although, if you get into subtleties about theft, that can get very interesting. But at least at the course level, I don't worry about it too much. But then there's the vow about intoxicants, and I really like wine. So I know if we're taking vows that it's, you know, forget about it. That one is, it's not like I'm a drunk or anything, but I love to cook, listen to jazz, and drink wine all at the same time. It's not something I learned in the Green Gulch Kitchen, of course, because that's not the way the Green Gulch Kitchen works, but it's one of my favorite things to do on Friday night is to drink a glass of wine while I whip up some sort of nice dinner while I'm listening to Jazz 24 on the internet. So those are one of the pleasures of my life. So I knew that there's no way I was going to give that up. So what can I say about taking vows when I know I take vows with the intention to do my best, but only in some areas? But the reason that I decided to go ahead and talk with you anyway is because there is one vow that I've taken that I knew I wasn't going to break. And because I'd taken that vow and I knew I wasn't going to break it, I actually also had to say yes to Sonia when I sort of figured that out. Because the vow that I'm talking about is the Bodhisattva vow, which, you know, for most people, when you first run into it, sounds outrageous. I vow to save all sentient beings, or I vow to save all beings. And how could anybody say such a thing? How could anybody intend such a thing? How could anybody even believe such a thing? So my story is that for a long time, I didn't believe that I could possibly take such a vow. And in the 1980s, this was sort of a problem, because I was living in Amherst. I was working at Amherst College, teaching at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, but there was a fellow who was teaching religious studies at Amherst College by the name of Robert Thurman, who at that time, as now, was very well connected into the Tibetan tradition and had his own little Buddhist studies school called the American Institute of Buddhist Studies. And he brought all these unbelievably profoundly experienced lamas to Amherst, and they would do talks, and then in the Tibetan way they would offer an initiation into something. So if you really wanted to practice, you needed to take the initiation. But you couldn't take the initiation if you didn't take the Bodhisattva vows, which also included the, you know, no intoxicants, etc., etc., etc. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I could manage those, and those would probably be pretty good for me if I could take them, but how can I possibly take the Bodhisattva vow? I know that my interest in Buddhism is straightening out my own twisted, warped mind and life, and that that's why I was doing what I was doing, and that's where, in the deepest level, my interest in the Dharma was. It was all about me, and I knew it. So how could I possibly take a vow like that? Well, you know, I could fudge it, but if you're sitting down in front of somebody who you believe can actually see your mind, as some of these great lamas can, then you can't fudge it. It's like you're sitting there and you're saying, I vow to do this, that, and the other thing, and you're looking at them with your hands like this, you know, and they're looking at you, and you know they can see you. And so now you're in deep doo-doo, right? So I couldn't do that either, because I really believe they could see what was going on, and I'm sure they could. So what am I going to do? So this happened quite frequently. But then there was this one lama who came to Amherst, and he was there for about 8-9 months. His name was Taratulku, and I mentioned him here before. And he came to Green Gulch starting around that time. And I spent a lot of time studying with him, because he was, the way Bob got him to the college was he engineered the loose visiting professorship for this lama to come. That particular year he had control over it. So Tara Rinpoche was teaching every day and every night, and I was with him every day and every night, and that went on for months, and it was sort of like this unbelievable experience and deep connection, and it was wonderful, and so on and so forth. So at one point I asked him, I said, would you teach me to meditate? Would you give me an initiation into Manjushri? Because I really wanted to practice Manjushri. I thought it would help my mind, help my translating, help my scholarly work, and so on and so forth. And he said, no, I will not. And I thought, oh, it's one of those things where you have to ask three times. So I asked him a second time. I've been watching Kung Fu on television or something. What did I know, right? So I asked him a second time. He said, no. Wow, okay. I got to ask him a third time. So I asked him a third time, and he said, no. I thought, oh, jeez. Okay, you know, what's wrong? I don't, what is this? All right, well, he said no three times. I didn't ask him a fourth time. Three times no? That's no. Okay, fine. But he taught a lot, and I just had the most profoundly wonderful relationship with him at that level. And then in the mid-1980s, I had moved to San Francisco, and I happened to see this poster when I was in Berkeley attending some lama's teaching that said Taratulku's at Green Gulch with some other people. I thought, holy, whoa! I jumped in my car, broke every speed limit getting over here, and walked in that door. When he was sitting right here, walked in that door just as he was finishing his talk, and we connected like that, and it was sort of like everything was different, and I knew everything was going to be different. And in fact, some of the people who were in the room and sort of were there at that moment said, what just happened? Like Yvonne Rand, who had sponsored him, remembers that. It was not like it was a big deal, it's just some people noticed something shifted a little bit. Kay was sitting in the room, my wife, she didn't notice anything. We didn't meet until some time later, so it wasn't that profound, obviously. But I did have a chance to talk with him, and I knew that when he came back again, because he was finishing his tour, that I would take some teachings from him. And sure enough, when he came back, he went to Amherst, and he had some teachings to offer, which were aligned with what I'd asked him about many years before, but he said, now I will teach you. So now I was in trouble, because in order to take the teachings, I was going to have to take all the vows that I had already thought I can't possibly take, that I know I'm going to break. And I have this devotion to this teacher, and I'm in this pickle, because I really want to study with him. I really want him to be my lama, and I have to take these vows, which I know I'm going to break, then I'm not capable of bodhisattva vow. How can I maintain this vow? This kind of thing. So now I'm stuck. I'm going to have to do it. So I went ahead and did that with profound trepidation. So what happened, though, was very interesting, and that's really the story of what I want to share with you. Not that all, that's all the prologue. That's the kind of the lead-in to this. What happened, which was interesting, was that over time, I realized that it was actually impossible to be a Buddhist practitioner, an actual Buddhist practitioner, without taking the bodhisattva vow. Even if you've never taken the vow, if you're a real practitioner, you're practicing like a bodhisattva. And it took me a while to sort that out and realize what that meant, which is what I'll share with you this evening to the extent that I can in my own experience. But it solved the problem. And kind of the way it solved the problem, to kind of try and cut to the quick of it to the extent that that's possible, is when I was thinking that I couldn't take the bodhisattva vow, what I was thinking was, here's me and there's all of you, and we're so utterly different, and I'm so focused on me that I can't possibly in any way be focused on anything that you need. I mean, that's pretty much the standard way we think about things, if we're honest. But it's based on the idea of me and you as being utterly different from each other, being utterly, totally different from each other. Well, as it turns out, as I think you know from your own studies, when you hold that idea very rigidly, you open the door to really profound suffering. Because when you're really focused on yourself to the exclusion of everybody else, a number of things become apparent. One thing that's apparent, if you're in a relationship with somebody, for example, is if you think you can make yourself happy without making the other person happy, you can see right away it doesn't work. You know, any husband that thinks that he can make himself happy by getting all the goodies or whatever the case may be, and that doesn't matter how his wife feels, is not going to have a happy marriage. It doesn't take any particular insight to see that's true. And that's sort of a metaphor, I think, for every relationship. And this is basic Buddhist teaching. We're all around each other all the time. And we live in each other's kind of mental space. I mean, even in the most mundane sense. And so if we go about living our lives in a way which generate friction and unhappiness all around us, it all comes back to us. We recognize it quite quickly. And it doesn't take very much to recognize that if we spend a little bit of time being friendly to other people or caring a little bit about other people, even if it's not really deep or very profound, even if we really care mostly about ourselves, but we spend a little bit of time trying to be nice to other people, you start seeing pretty quickly that something starts coming back to you. I mean, I often say that one of my basic practices is friendliness, and it has become that. And because I live in a small town in Oregon rather than in a big city, it's actually much easier to practice friendliness and much more necessary because I see the same people over and over again. There aren't a whole lot of absolute strangers where I live. There may be 12, 15,000 people in the county, but I see the same people in the same Safeway when I go grocery shopping every single time I go grocery shopping. And the same people in the same restaurants who are cooking, working behind the counter, working as waiters and waitresses. We're always running into each other. And so on the most mundane level, it became completely apparent to me, not necessarily in Eastern Oregon, but in life generally, although I see it strongly in Eastern Oregon, that if you practice friendliness with other people, and even the most minimal amount of caring about them, it all comes back to you tenfold over. Tenfold over. If I'm nice to the waitresses, it's so much more pleasant to be in that restaurant. And the checkout people at Safeway really like treating being treated like human beings rather than automatons scanning things. They really like it, and you really feel how much they like it. And it doesn't take a great deal of effort. Okay, but what does that really have to do with the bodhisattva vow? I mean, that's being friendly, and that's kind of, that is a Buddhist virtue. Friendliness is a Buddhist virtue. But what does that have to do with the bodhisattva vow? Well, the same process that's at work in that mundane kind of simple level is actually at work in the more profound level. I mean, the reason that I practice friendliness is because there's some part of me that still imagines that I and you are fundamentally separate. So I'm practicing friendliness in relationship to you because I think of you as being separate from me. But when you study Madhyamaka, when you study middle way philosophy, Nagarjuna, for example, which I've been studying for years, as some of you know, you start looking at the rational or the logical analysis about the nature of selfhood, about the nature of self, and where does the idea of self come from that we so firmly experience and grasp at. And one thing that becomes clear when you begin to investigate rationally the arguments, I'm not talking about some kind of esoteric take it on faith anything, I'm talking about using your good, clear, rational mind to investigate what is the nature of self and to learn the arguments that Buddhists such as Nagarjuna produce about the nature of self. What becomes very clear in the arguments is that the concept of self can only exist if there's a concept of other. Without the notion of other, self has no meaning. It's like left and right. Left does not mean anything without right. It simply doesn't. And although there is temperature, hot doesn't mean anything without cold. It's true that we can look at a thermometer and we can read 105, we can read 95, we can read 80, but that's not hot or cold. Those are just numbers, right? But that 105 is hot and that 30 is cold, those things relate to each other in a certain way. Because for some people, 30 will be hot, but then something else will be cold. Okay. But the point is that these ideas, they do relate to each other and they define each other and they can't exist without each other. Time is like that too. Nagarjuna points out very clearly, and his arguments are very clear on the subject, that the only way we know the difference between past, present, and future, which is the basis upon which we have the idea of time, is that they define each other. The only way we know the future is because we know it's not the present or the past. The only way we know it's the past is it's not the present or the future. Now you can look at this empirically and try and come up with something else, but the concepts of past, present, and future, and even our experience of what constitutes past, present, and future, they interdepend and they define each other. So I don't want to get onto a thing about time. We could get into that, and that would get very complicated, and we go down that rabbit hole, take a long time to extract ourselves from it. But the idea of self and other is probably simpler, because intuitively I think we can understand that we know conceptually now. I'm not talking about here's somebody sitting over here, and here's somebody sitting over here, and I'm sitting over here, and what does this mean? I'm talking about what's going on in my conceptual experience. We know conceptually that self only has meaning if other is a concept that's held up to define it, and that other only has meaning if self is held up to define it. That I know conceptually, and therefore construct a world through my mind in which self and other are oppositional. In fact, you know, we say that people who don't create boundaries between self and other have various kinds of problems. At the deepest level, we call them schizophrenic. We say that if you can't separate yourself with good boundaries from other people, that you're schizophrenic, right? Which is maybe true or maybe not true. I'm just saying that that's sort of the common way of viewing things. So I'm not going to go down too far down that line of the truth in my experience of self and other depending on each other. But the point is that it became clear to me that that was true through my own intellectual studies of Nagarjuna and then applying it to meditative practice, to look at my experience internally of self and look at my internal experience of what appeared to be other and how they related to each other. And when I could see on a logical, rational level how there was something fundamentally fictional about the ideas I was holding, things began to shift. Now you can say, well, yeah, that's all true, but in time space, there are a whole bunch of bodies in this room and they're all separate from each other. So there's the self and there's the other. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about my inner conceptual experience, which is not quite the same thing, because I'm constructing reality through my inner conceptual experience. I'm not talking about the objective thing that's going on out there. So in middle way philosophy, sometimes a good metaphor is like movies in a movie screen. It's sort of like, in my mind, I'm creating this movie, which is all of you, but it doesn't mean that there isn't a movie screen out there, that there is an objective base out there upon which I'm constructing and projecting certain ideas. It's not an idealist philosophy if it's all in your mind. This is a certain way of interpreting middle way philosophy. So within that context, it became clear that if I said I can't take the bodhisattva vow, then I was being, I don't want to say untrue to, but I was rejecting the very philosophy that I was devoting myself to study. Because I was saying, Nagarjuna is wrong. If I say I can't take the bodhisattva vow because there's only me and I don't care about anybody else, or if I say I can't take the bodhisattva vow because how can I possibly vow to be a benefit to all beings, then I was basically saying that all the logical arguments that I knew were true somehow at the same time were false. And I was being hypocritical to myself, let alone anybody else, because I was saying when I'm studying philosophy, I take it to be true. But if I have to testify in front of my lama, I'm going to say it's false. Well, I couldn't do that. And I didn't have to do that. It sort of showed itself to me in time. But I took it on faith that I would do the vow. I would take the vow because I loved him so much and I was so devoted to him. And I saw him as being such pure, or as Yvonne Rand said, impeccable teacher, that I would commit myself to something that I believed was beyond me. And then it turned out that it was just a fiction in my own mind to believe that it was beyond me. Because the truth of the matter was, day in and day out, it was the truth of the matter without my having to think about it, that I was connected with everybody, and that every time I did something to benefit myself, when I understood how self and other really connected to each other, if it truly benefited myself, it benefited everybody around me. If it was a fiction about the way it benefited myself, then it didn't benefit anybody else around me. It also didn't benefit me. It was merely a fiction that it was going to benefit me. So really doing things that benefited myself really benefited everybody, if that makes any sense, right? So when I was truly friendly to people, we all got the goodies. That's really what it boiled down to. When I truly cared about myself, I cared about myself because I cared about my relationship with other people, and everybody benefited on that basis. Now, once that got itself sorted out, at least intellectually, I started noticing some very interesting things. For example, I had these thoughts that I was mostly concerned about myself and nobody else mattered, and that's still ongoing, you know. We all think we're the center of the cosmos. How many people are in this room? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Every one of us thinks we're the center of the world. 16 centers of the world. I'm not sure that that's actually possible, but every one of us, even though we know that, is convinced we're the center of everything. That's pretty deeply ingrained within us, even though we know it's not going to be true. But I started noticing things beyond that. Which is kind of an intellectual trick in a certain way. But when I started, one of the things I started noticing was about my own thoughts. So once I was not so convinced that I was totally separate from everybody else, but rather that we are all deeply interconnected, because when you go from the rational idea of self and other or a fiction, you start noticing on the experiential level that self and other are kind of a fiction. When that started happening, interesting things began to show themselves to me, such as I'd be sitting in a conversation with, I'd be having a conversation with somebody, and I'd start thinking thoughts that I didn't recall ever thinking before. Why am I thinking this? Who really is irritated here? Am I really bugged by this other person? And am I bugged in the way in which I'm hearing thoughts about the way in which I'm bugged? I started noticing this kind of thing, and what I began to realize was I wasn't sure whose thoughts were happening in my head. Were they my thoughts or were they somebody else's thoughts? You know, I'd be sitting and having a conversation with one of my faculty colleagues, and I'd be experiencing all this envy, for example. And I think, I'm not envious of this person. Why am I having these envy thoughts? And I've had this really interesting and great career. Why am I envious of this person who has basically just started out in life and doesn't have too much experience? What am I envying? That they're young, that they're new, but that's not what these thoughts are sounding like. Whose thoughts were those? Were they their thoughts? Were they my thoughts? Were they thoughts occurring in a space that we share? What's going on here? Well, it's not like I can answer that question. Well, maybe I could try and answer that question, but that would go down another rabbit hole, actually, if I tried to do that. But the point is, I wasn't so sure anymore who was thinking those thoughts. Or Kay and I have been together over, I don't know, what have been 28 years. We've been together 28 years, I think, at this point. I can't tell you how many times I'll have this idea that I want to do something, and she'll say, I was just thinking of doing that. Or, yeah, that's a good idea, because that's what I've been wanting to do, but I didn't say anything. But where did that thought come from? Was that my thought in her head? Was that her thought in my head? Was it something that came from outer space and kind of plopped into both of our heads? I mean, I don't know how to answer that question, but it happens all the time, you know? And so whose thought is it? Is there an us which is somehow inclusive of her and me in some way which is more truly the two of us? And that doesn't mean that we're not separate, but in what way are we not separate? I mean, we are separate, but we're not separate. So I don't know how to explain this. It's, I mean, rationally speaking, it doesn't quite fit in certain ways. Buddhism explains it from the point of view of deep levels of interdependence, where bodies connect in certain ways. I mean, we're sharing the same air in this room. It may be the case that our bodies are in different locations, but we're breathing the same air, and we know that there's nothing more important than breath. I mean, if there's anything that we're going to grasp onto in any given moment, if you try and take it away, it's going to be breath. You can take my dinner away, you can take my tea away, but if you take my breath away, I'm going to grab back very fast. Okay. But that's something we share. You know, what I inhale now, you're inhaling a minute from now. So we share that really very deeply. And we share the space that we're all looking at. I'm looking at you, you're looking at me, but we're sharing the space. We're seeing something. We're sensing something. We're sharing the space. Our minds are moving around this space together. We're replicating this space jointly. As you're listening to me and I'm listening to me, all of our minds are attuning to that sound and those concepts in a certain way. And it's true, at some level, everyone's hearing something different and seeing something different. But at some level, we're also hearing something that's the same and seeing something that's the same. So, end of story, right? So what I realize is that it's not possible to do anything but to take the bodhisattva vow. It's not possible to do anything but be a bodhisattva in one's practice, because if you're doing anything else, you're increasing your own ignorance and you're increasing your own suffering. And if you're really on the Dharma path, if you're really on the practice path, and you're really making efforts to reduce your own suffering and to bring some peace of mind to yourself, you'll be doing that for everybody all at the same time. It's absolutely totally unavoidable. We only think it's avoidable, which of course is the main problem, I suppose. But in reality, it's totally unavoidable. Anyway, now I'm sounding preachy and I didn't mean to. What I really mean to do is say, this is what my experience has been. And it's not like I remember it all the time. Sonia and I were talking about remembering and forgetting. You know, I can get on the freeway and I can be as pissed off at other drivers as anybody else. You know, and we're all enclosed in these little metal things. And it's like, where I live, the main thing that bugs me is not fast freeway drivers, it's humongous trucks. In La Grande, life hasn't achieved its ultimate purpose if you don't have a big truck with a couple dogs in the back of it. And the dogs are barking, and the trucks are diesel, and they stink, and they're noisy, and they're loud, and that's what life is all about. And it bugs the bejesus out of me, you know. So, yeah, I forget all the time, too, right? But then there's other times when I do remember, you know, and that seems to be a lot of what practice is about, remembering it, and then forgetting it, and then remembering it. But the point is, it is possible to take the bodhisattva vow, because it's only saying for me, anyhow, I'm preachy again. I've learned that for me it's possible to take the bodhisattva vow, which I've now done many times, in front of lamas who can see straight through me from one end to the other, who know all my limitations, but I could take the vow with all seriousness and with all sincerity, because deep down inside, some part of me has gotten the message. And so that's pretty much what I wanted to share with you. Okay, so Q&A, right?
One of the other things that we talked about this morning and in the class we talked about is the limits of what we can know. Mm. And you were talking about the 2%. And that was interesting to me when we were talking about kind of vow or practice.
Oh.
And that exchanging of self and other, or what self, or visible or invisible beings.
You would like me to talk about this? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, Sonia and I had this very interesting conversation this morning. I'm going to replicate for the recording because I'm sure that whoever's listening to this couldn't hear you over there because you're very soft-spoken. That this morning, Sonia and I were kind of sitting in the Tenzo office and our minds were wandering around after I finally committed to doing this. And one of the things that Sonia mentioned was the research that has come out of physics that something like a quarter, what is it, 22%, 4%, is either 2 or 4% of what exists we're aware of, or we can be aware of. And then there's another 22%, which is called dark matter, which we can't be aware of, but which we don't know anything about. But that still only accounts for about a quarter of what we know, the scientists know exists. And then there's three quarters of what exists that they don't even know what it is or how to refer to it. They just know it's got to be there because of the way, I guess, it has an impact on the other quarter. So and it fits interestingly into Madhyamakas, because Madhyamaka really, to a great extent, is about learning the limits of what's knowable. I mean, it falls under the sort of the rubric of designation. In the end, there are many Madhyamaka schools, to be honest about this, but the school I follow, which is technically called Prasangika Madhyamika, it's a school of the Dalai Lama lineages, the Gelugpa lineages in Tibet, all my teachers. And that's the reason I follow it, for the most part, that's the reason I follow it. Finally, it just comes to saying that there's basically, what we're experiencing is designations, concepts, conceptual structures, which are imposing on some sort of dynamic, moving reality that we don't know much of anything about, which means we know the limits of knowledge. The limits of knowledge are our conceptual structures, but we know there's something beyond our conceptual structures, but we also know that we can't know what it is because it's beyond our conceptual structures. So that fits with this idea of dark matter and then all the other three quarters of what exists that they don't even know how to refer to it as, or how, in what way to refer to it. That was pretty bad English. Anyway, so what does this mean? Well, If there's all this stuff going on that we can't be aware of, what is it? Does it include living beings? I mean, why is it that life is only included within the limit of what we can understand and know? I mean, couldn't there be life forms that we can't perceive? I mean, dogs perceive things that we can't perceive. Many creatures perceive things we can't perceive. And we can perceive things now with instruments that we can't perceive with our ordinary senses. So there's nothing particularly mysterious about that. But then there's all that stuff that we can't perceive, so we don't know what's out there. So if we're honest, all kinds of stuff could be out there, including life forms that we couldn't know anything about. And if that's the case, we don't really know who's in this room with us. Okay, now that's interesting. If we don't know who's in this room with us, we might want to be really careful about what we say and do, you know. It's like I was saying, well, you know, it's like with our Christian friends, you know, it's like they believe Jesus is there paying attention.
Angels,
right? So, you know, if Jesus or if angels are in this room with us, would we be doing stuff different? I mean, you know, would you be cheating on your taxes? Or like if somebody dropped $5 and you didn't give it back to them, but you put it in your own pocket when they walked away, how would you feel about it? That kind of thing, you know? It's like, well, if Jesus was sitting here, you'd chase that person down and say, you dropped your $5, you know? Thank you, Lord. Here's the $5, you know? It's like, you would do that, right? I mean, I know I behave differently when my llamas are around. It's like, phew, they're paying attention, right? So I better clean up my act. Well, you don't know who's here paying attention. So the thing about vows is, if you are thinking that these great teachers who suggested these modes of behavior to us and suggested strongly we might want to adopt them, we call vows, what are they aware of that we're not aware of? Do they know who's in the room with us that we don't know is in the room with us, that might be paying attention, that we might want to not have noticing those little shortcuts, transgressions, and whatnots that we're involved in? That was an interesting conversation. I mostly don't like to think about those sorts of things because it's sort of like a heavy weight. It's a very heavy weight to think about that as being possible. But it's an interesting way to think about vows, and that's what we were sort of having a little chat about. And we have questions, but I'll take them in order of the hands going up. And Kay's was first.
I just thought you might want to say something in relationship to training for vows in terms of transforming negative habit patterns of mind into positive habit patterns of mind, and some of the examples that you've used of that. Because you can actually use that towards training yourself to keep the vows, too, and see them seen in as positive states of mind. Yeah, I was thinking that too, so there we go.
I don't know anything about mind transformation or mind training.
Well, no, like you know, like I used to use the story of cigarette smoking, letting go of cigarette smoking, how you can transform a negative habit
into a positive?
Into a positive one, because that also has to do with learning how to
keep vows. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I understand now what you're asking. Okay. Okay, mind training and vows, based on my own limited experience, since I'm a great vow breaker. So, except for this one, except for the big vow, I'm a big vow breaker. So I used to smoke cigarettes, not very many, maybe a half a dozen in a day was the most I ever smoked, but it's still an unwholesome habit that I wanted to let go of, and it was the kind of habit that I broke about 50 or 60 times before I finally broke the habit, which is to say I failed 59 out of 60 times. What I found in the end, and for me, I mean, I've known people who stopped smoking cigarettes, they just went cold turkey. It kind of blows my mind that they could do that, but I couldn't. But what I found for me was that ending cigarette smoking really was kind of a mind training practice, because in any given moment I would have a choice. So I'm going to relate this to vows generally in a minute. In any given moment I would have a choice. Do I want to smoke that cigarette or not? And sometimes I would, and sometimes I would not. So every time I chose not to, it actually made it easier to choose not to the next time, because I had sort of increased the strength of the habit of not smoking. But every time I went ahead and I had that cigarette, then it made it harder to not have a cigarette the next time, because I had reinforced the habit of smoking. And the two things were kind of going on at the same time. You know, the non-smoking habit and the smoking habit were like, there were two horses that were racing along, like, you know, sometimes they were neck and neck and things are changing. So sometimes I would just say, oh, everything is so stressful, I've got to have a smoke. You know, and other times I'd be feeling like, I need to have a smoke, and I'd say, why? What is that all about? I'm not going to do it. And so I noticed over time that the don't smoke habit was just incrementally getting a little bit stronger than the smoke habit, until finally there was some kind of like a tipping point where cigarettes actually started to smell disgusting to me, and then that was the end of it. As soon as that tipping point was reached, and I think the reason it was reached was the non-smoking habit had gotten so strong that the smoking habit had gotten weaker, that tipping point was reached, and then I stopped smoking. And to me, that was a great learning experience about mind training, if you will, because it was a moment-by-moment decision that was going to be made. You know, the desire would come up, and would I act on it or not? And I didn't get into a whole lot of guilt about the whole thing, like, oh my God, I just had a cigarette, I'm a rotten person. It was more like, okay, I just had a cigarette, it means that habit was stronger than this habit, you know. So I didn't let that other stuff get in the way. And I think you could probably apply that to anything, you know. Whatever it is that you've taken a vow to do, or taken a vow not to do, or to say, or to think, because vows are at the level of thought, speech, and actual action, right? So if you've taken a vow in any of those categories, in any of those ways, each time you decide to or not to, you're either reinforcing or non-reinforcing. And so that might be an interesting way to think about vows and the keeping of vows. I mean, you may be somebody that needs to take a vow to avoid intoxicants, because it might be something that's out of control. And I'm sure that in the 12-step programs they have a lot more to say about this than I ever could. But sometimes you succeed and sometimes you fail. And I think the only thing that's important is that whatever the choice you're making is that you keep working on it so that success at what you're seeking occurs more frequently than failure and the occurrence of what you're not seeking. And eventually one outweighs the other, and I'll bet there's a tipping point in there someplace where you just say, that just doesn't even feel good anymore. You know, I can see it. That's not going to happen. So is that the sort of thing you were thinking of? That's more okay. All right. So maybe I know a little bit about vows. Your question. That answered your question too. Two birds with one stone. Perfect.
I was just thinking of all the things that we used to not know, but now we do.
Right.
You know, we know a lot about bacteria and how they're related, and how amazing that is, and that there is consciousness, some kind of consciousness.
Really?
Yeah.
I believe. No. When I said really, that wasn't to say that's wrong, but I didn't know that.
Form a symbiosis with another form of life in order to help each other. So, you know, it sounds very much like a conscious act there, you know, in a different way from, you know, not human consciousness. But
right.
It looks like there is a lot that we really have no access to yet, but there are people working on that, and I think it's very exciting. And also, the other thing is electronics. You know, things that are now so obvious, and we just do it, we just use it. But how did this work? How is this
right.
You know, possible? Amazing.
We just take it for granted that I can.
Yeah,
that I can, you know, look at my smartphone and find out what the weather is in Dublin.
Yeah.
Like, you know, do I want to call my brother? No, he's going to be in a bad mood because it's pouring rain in Dublin. He lives in Dublin. Well, no, we got it worked out. It's like we call each other at certain times of the, you know. It's like, I know when not to call him. He's, a, you know, like that. But Kay and I were, go farther along these lines of symbiotic conscious relationships between animals, where the notion of self and other has got to be defined differently than we might, as humans, think of it as being defined. Kay and I were in Yellowstone Park a few weeks ago, and we overheard this ranger talk. Now, ordinarily, I'm kind of an arrogant, I'm not going to go listen to a ranger talk, you know, like that sort of thing. But I happened to hear this ranger talk, and it kind of zapped my brain. And what this was about was this ranger was talking about the relationship between ravens and wolves. So I've been interested in wolves, and wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, but I've been interested in wolves because they've also been coming into the area of eastern Oregon, and it's a big bone of contention between the ranchers and, you know, why do we want these things here and all this kind of stuff. And Kay is a big fan of ravens, and when she paints Tonkas, there's always a raven someplace in the Tonkas, and there's a long story about why that is that I won't go into, but they're like her little signature, you know, little sneaky little raven doing something off in a corner in some way. Mostly because, well, we saw these unusual ravens that were actors in the Grand Canyon, and we kept looking at them saying, are you doing this acting for us? And then this raven would go, zzz, and grab some branch and spin around and hop up and look at us like, yeah, that was for you. You know, okay, we got the message. These are smart birds, you know. And so they started appearing in her paintings. But the point is, to get back to my story, what we found out by listening to this ranger talk was that when wolf pups are born, the ravens show up and they play with their food. So the wolf pups get very familiar with ravens, the sound of ravens, the raven being, and that they're okay. That ravens and wolf pups bond at the time the wolf pups are born.
Did you play with the pups' food?
What's that?
Who plays with whose food?
The ravens play with the food that's brought to the pups. Mm-hmm. They steal a little bit, but mostly they just play with it, and they play with the wolf pups. So why is this? Well, the reason for this is when the wolves are grown and they go out hunting in their packs, they have great smell and all this sort of thing, and they have great knowledge for what the herds are doing. But what they can't see is they can't see the herd from up in the sky. But the ravens can see the herds from up in the sky, and they can recognize when there's a weak animal in the herd, and they identify it for the wolves. And they'll fly over, this is according to the ranger, they'll fly over where the wolf pups are, where the weaker animals are, and they'll circle them in a certain way and caw in a certain way, which indicates to the wolf pack where to go. Now, why would the raven want to do this? Well, the ravens want to do this because the wolves will be interested in large mammals. They're not interested in little mammals like coyotes. When a coyote successfully hunts and gets an animal, it eats everything. There's nothing left over. But when a wolf pack gets an animal, they'll eat and there's a lot left over. And then the ravens show up and they get what's left. Now, a raven cannot bring down an elk. That's never going to happen. So if ravens were dependent upon their own hunting skills to get elk, there'd be no ravens left. But wolves do very well with that. So the ravens help the wolves get their prey. And then the wolves leave a lot for the ravens to eat. And the wolves are glad to do that because the ravens help them find the prey. And they already have that relationship established from the time they were pups. And this is an intentional, conscious, symbiotic relationship. The ravens show up when the pups are born. They know what they're doing. So self and other. Where is raven self and wolf self? Where do they start and end? You know, where do they start and end? So anyway, there you go. More? Anything else?
Yeah.
more than enough.
Ravens and kale? Was it ravens?
Ravens and kale?
They
pull out the seedlings.
The ravens pull out the kale seedlings?
They just don't eat the plant and they just go one after another.
That doesn't sound very symbiotic in relationship with you.
We don't know yet. We don't know why they do it.
You don't know what's going on yet.
They think that they were in the compost yard. They would find the little plugs in and pull the plugs out and there'd be worms or something.
Oh, and they would want the worms.
So then they picked up that
plug.
Oh,
it's the plugs that you have to.
When they're out in the field and they see a plug, they pull the plug out.
Looking for a worm underneath there. Right, that's not a very symbiotic relationship with Green Gulch farmers. Training and patience. Training and patience. All righty.
What do you do, or is there a way that you work with forgetting, kind of like turning towards waking up?
It's easy to work with forgetting. I forget all the time. That one's no problem. No, but what do you mean, Sonia? I'm not clear.
Well, I'm more interested in catching yourself. How do you remember?
How do you catch yourself in certain ways?
To turn toward.
A rosary is helpful. For example, a rosary, a mala. It doesn't seem to be a big deal in Zen because you want to sit still when you're doing Zazen. But in the Vajrayana tradition, you use a lot of mantras. And mantra means mind protector. That's literally what the Sanskrit refers to, mind protector. So if you're wanting to practice with the idea of compassion, you might be repeating Om Mani Padme Hum over and over again. And if you know the meaning of the mantra, so that it's not just a gibberish, right, then it does turn your mind toward that intention, remembering that. Because I'm mostly a practitioner who's interested in the wisdom line of things. A mantra that is important to me is Om Vakedan Nama, and it refers to it's pronounced that way, but it refers to the Sanskrit vak, which means word, means the one with the holy word, or Manjushri, as in the Manjushri that's in the Zendo. And I find that if I repeat this mantra with appropriate visualizations, my mind actually does get sharper and more attentive. So a lot of times I want to practice with that, like before doing a talk like this. Like, what am I going to say? Well, I'll sharpen up my mind. But it's hard to remember to do the mantra because your mind will wander. But if you're holding a rosary, and you're turning the beads, you have this physical thing with your body to remind you. It's like, oh, my mind just wandered away, and I'll remember that because I've got the beads in my hand that I'm turning. Click, 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 click. And that'll bring me back to remembering the mantra over and over again. So that's one way in which I can practice remembering. Other than that, I don't have anything useful to say because my mind is so scattered and I'm so distracted in my life that I wouldn't have anything intelligent to share with you that would be at all useful. But that I can share with you because I do know that that's very useful. I don't know how useful it is for you as Zen practitioners, though. Obviously it's not going to work in the Zendo, but it might work outside.
Uh-huh.
Like, give some examples.
Which foot do you use to step over the threshold?
Right.
When do you bow and when do you turn right? And when,
The forms.
The
forms are the reminders. There you go. Thank you. In the Zen tradition, the forms are the reminders. I had an argument before I came down here with a friend of mine who was making a lot of noise about disliking Zen. Why is it you dislike Zen? Well, they're all attached to the forms. Everything has to be done in the right way. What a pain in the ass. And I said, well, I don't think so. So now that you're reminding me of this, I said, well, I don't think so. I think what they're doing through the forms is they're transmitting a quality of mindfulness from one generation of Zen student to another. And if they didn't have the forms and everybody just made everything up as they went, what would the Zen look like in a generation or two? It would be kind of who knows what. So that I think that's a good thing. And my friend thought I was out of my mind. He said, that's too rigid. Who needs that stuff? Well, fine, you go your way. They'll go their way, and I'll go my way, which is sort of my way. Whatever that way. Well, Reb said, when I first saw him on this visit, he said, ah, Buddhist heretic, welcome. It was very interesting. I talked to him about this tonight. Buddhist heretic. Buddhist heretic.
I heard that
welcome.
He was telling part of the story.
Well, whatever.
What, remember.
That's the story.
But why would he say you were a heretic?
He wanted me, he likes the idea that I'm here to churn things up, I think. Just, you know, to kind of like make people look at things in a different way. Nagarjuna is good for that. So I think that that's, I mean, when I wrote him, I said I'd like to come and do some teaching and spend some time with old friends and enjoy the land.
Did it come after you said you were moving to Oregon permanently?
I don't think that those two had anything to do with each other. Yeah. No, anyhow, you know, he said, well, you know, if you want to hang that thing on yourself, that's fine. And I thought, well, I like that, actually, you know. I like that a lot because I have a lot of coyote in me. You know, if you know the Indian view of coyote, it's sort of like coyote's a little tricky. Nagarjuna is very tricky. So I like that. That's okay. I mean, we don't burn heretics anymore, so it's okay to... it's okay.
Mel Weitzman said in a lecture at Tassahara, he said, rules are there to be broken.
Oh, an abbot.
An abbot.
Oh, my goodness. Asking for trouble. Well, Mel knows what he's talking about, so it must be. It must be okay. Yeah. Alrighty. Well, I don't know. Are rules there to be broken? Mick was talking about the difference between rules and principles, and that was a very interesting conversation. So let me close with that segue, because I thought that was interestingly insightful. He says, you know, rules, those are things we make up to guide ourselves or control ourselves or what have you. He said, but I'm broadly paraphrasing him. But principles, when we see how things work, we recognize that the way they work, they're principles that describe how things work. So you can break rules, but you can't break principles, because principles are just the way things work. And that's an interesting distinction. So maybe we should not have a bodhisattva vow that we think of as a rule. Maybe we should think of the bodhisattva vow as a principle. It's a principle, because even if we want to break it, we can't, because it's reality. Yes.
Feel like reality shifts.
Feel like what?
Reality changes.
Reality changes.
It's so changing. Oh, I mean, principles, I feel like, can be ever-changing. You can't break them, but you can bend them, maybe.
Because reality changes, the principles change.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. All right. I don't know if I agree with you that reality changes. I'm not saying you're wrong. You know, we just have two different views on this particular thing. If you're comfortable with reality changing and your reality changes, that's okay. I am much more into reality doesn't change. I know that's maybe a weird thing for a middle-way philosopher to say. But I do think that there's something that is consistent, just personal, okay, not right or wrong. I think that there's something underlying which is consistent, which is sort of knowable. And what it is what Buddhists call emptiness. And I don't think that emptiness changes. Emptiness can't change because it's empty. Just my own view.
Sure.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
Okay. But the reality that's floating around here, that makes sense that it would change. This one. That makes sense. That makes sense to me anyway that it would change. I don't want to be contentious though. So does that work? Do you think we might agree?
Agree?
Uh oh.
No, we can share perspectives.
Okay. We can agree to disagree.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay.
It sounds like there's levels of reality.
Oh, it's 8:30. We've been talking. We've been talking for an hour. let's not go there. One more question, and then I think it's time to turn in.
Where in Eastern Washington do you live?
Eastern Oregon, a town called La Grande. It's the sort of place that most people know because they drove through it on the way to someplace else. It's true. It's true. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Okay.
kind of been working on how to phrase this. I'm not really sure I'll
okay.
be able to communicate it as I'd like to, but I give it a shot. I feel like a concern for myself or something that I notice is the sincerity with which I take vows. And at the intellectual level, it's fairly easy for me to understand, yeah, we're all connected, that makes sense. And I believe that it makes sense, I see it. But there's this kind of disconnect in
mm-hmm.
then enacting it.
Sure.
Finding that habit patterns of, and maybe I've just enforced them for so long that, like you described, well, I had a smoke that time, or
right.
I'm doing something that's harming myself, which is
right.
therefore harming
right.
other beings.
Right.
And then this kind of being in a place where I'm encouraged and wanting to take this vow to say well beings, and yet feeling kind of insincere in this.
Right.
But then I walk outside the Zendo and I ignore somebody or I do something
right.
that is kind of, why am I doing that? It's not what I've...
Right.
Am I being insincere to this vow? Or, as you said, is it just kind of at some point there's a tipping point where you realize, oh, I don't want to do that anymore because I did that before and it didn't work out? Or maybe you just have words of encouragement. I don't know if that's what I'm looking for. But just,
well, well, okay, I'm not going to try and repeat everything you just said for the microphone, but what you described is the situation that I'm in day in and day out all the time, and that we're all in day in and day out all the time. And it doesn't contradict what I just got through saying. The mainstream Buddhist teaching is that we've all been grasping after self from beginningless time. Self-centered, selfish grasping after self has been an affliction that we've all dealt with in this life, from the beginning of this life. And if you believe in former lives, we dealt with it in former lives. It's been there all the time. And it's sort of a core problem. But as I said, with my example of smoking, you can work two habits at the same time. And you can go back and forth. And 1 minute, you're stuck in the horrible self-grasping. Okay, I'm going to have a smoke. And every once in a while, you can emerge from that and with sincerity do something that is altruistic by the common definition of altruistic. And you just go back and forth between them until one habit gets stronger and the other habit gets weaker. Believe me, the person that's sitting here talking to you is not a saint and not a bodhisattva. By those great definitions, right? I screw up as much as anybody, if not more. But that doesn't mean I don't keep trying, and that's the real point, is that you keep trying because at some place within yourself you recognize the value of that. I'm going to quote the Dalai Lama on this particular one because he kind of gets this sort of question a lot. And what he says is, look, it's perfectly okay to care about yourself. It's like when Americans take the vow to save all sentient beings, he said, you guys always forget that includes you. When I take the vow to save all sentient beings, I'm taking the vow to save me in addition to everybody else. It's not like everybody but me. I'm not vowing to save everybody but me. I'm vowing to save everybody including me. He said, If you feel really strongly that your main concern is yourself, which most people do, he says, so if you're going to be selfish, be wise selfish instead of being stupid selfish. What does it mean to be wise selfish? This is what it means to be wise selfish. When you take the bodhisattva vow, when you practice friendliness, when you start caring about other people in whatever way it's possible, that's being wise selfish because you are taking care of yourself that way. And in time, some sort of, you know, small tipping points start to happen. I mean, I can say that's true. I'm not going to be preachy here. I'm just going to say out of my own experience. These small tipping points start to happen where you see that friendliness really works and you want to be friendly and it becomes to come naturally. And well, that's a real kind of altruism, you know.
It makes you happy.
Thank you. It does make me happy. It does make me happy. And it makes other people happy. And it makes life a whole lot more fun. People used to, now I'm finding out that people used to say committo. God, what a grouch. You know, what is, it's like arrogant, you know, it's like, ugh. And now that I've been practicing friendliness for a while, they're saying things like, well, now that I've gotten to know you, you really seem like an okay kind of person. What was going on there? It was like, well, you know, I'm shy. I'm really a shy person, you know, and so I didn't say anything to you because I didn't really know what to say. Oh, well, you really seem like an arrogant snot. And I said, well, maybe I am. I don't know, but it seemed to me I was just shy, so I didn't say anything. Well, you're really kind of friendly. Well, I have to work at it. Well, it's working. Do it more. Okay. So, yeah, it's like that.
But I think also if you want to quit smoking, you don't right away go into a smoking club.
No, that's a good idea.
If you get stable,
yeah.
Then maybe at some point, go to that, the non-smoker can go into a smoking club or whatever.
So maybe.
I think that you also connected, there's some way that you connect with some other people.
Oh, a non-smoking club. Go into a non-smoking club?
Well, I mean, you just connect it with people that are kind of helping you remember.
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely want to do that.
Get your stability first and whatever it is.
Yeah, you definitely want to do that. It's like Kay said, I wanted to marry a Buddhist. She said.
That's what Sangha
is, too. That's what this is. You know, that's what this is. This is the non-smoking club.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
Sort of. when I worked in the kitchen with Kathy Egan and a number of us, we all went out and back and had a cigarette every once in a while. We're all smokers, so it wasn't exactly the non-smoking club. But that was then, and this is now. So yeah, you want mutual support. You want to be around people, especially when you're a newbie at some habit. You want to be around people who are also trying to reinforce that habit. If you want to give up drinking, you really don't want to spend time in nightclubs. You know, it's really not a good thing. And if you really want to take the Buddhist life seriously, it's good to spend some time around Sangha. For us, being at Green Gulch was really wonderful that way. It was wonderful to share being with people who had similar intention. Being around Tibetan Buddhists was really wonderful. And being around people who share aspiration is just great. It's one of the reasons we started a Buddhist group in La Grande, because we wanted some Sangha around, and the only way it was going to happen is if we started it, because it wasn't going to fall out of the sky. Not in Eastern Oregon, that's for sure. A lot of things fall out of the sky, but Sangha isn't one of them. So, yeah. I'll kind of leave it at that, though. I'm running out of steam. Okay? Thank you for coming. Thank you for letting me tell you my stories. I hope they're useful. Good night.